Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Stopping Iran from developing nuclear weapons has been a priority of many in the international community for years. Nuclear talks with Iran broke down again in June, and last week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu turned up the heat, threatening to attack with or without the support of the United States. With this backdrop, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted a forum on Monday that asked the question on the minds of many, should the U.S. go to war with Iran? Former U.S. Senator Bob Bennett, Vice Admiral Richard Gallagher, a retired military representative to NATO, and industrialist and philanthropist Khosrow Semnani, author of a policy paper on the human costs of military strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, joined me on a panel to answer that question. Today on the program, we're broadcasting parts of that discussion. Iran says that its nuclear program is solely to produce nuclear power. And I asked the panelists why many believe that isn't so.
This is a $64,000 question that everybody would like to have an answer for. The claims of Iranian government is one thing, but their actions and some of the rhetoric is another thing. We have to be sensitive to that. If you listen to what has been going on in the recent past since 2002, the information that's available to us, Iranian government, although it claims that its program it is for peaceful purposes, but if you look at the type of operations that they have conducted in terms of the concentration of the material, today they own over 189 kilograms of 20% enriched 235 uranium hexafluoride. Well, that is way over what a facility that requires only for research. The research, Iraq Research Facility or Tehran facility requires only between 15 to 25 kilograms. Why do they need 200 kilograms? That's one of the indications that they are really going over and above what's needed and causes a lot of concern for other people. Other countries, mainly Israel and United States. The other thing that is going on is all of the rhetoric that Mr. Khamenei is talking about having in one of his assessments that just recently came up in September of 2012, he claims that the whole Middle East must be nuclear weapon-free region. Now, you cannot talk about Iran program without talking about Israel. Israel has nuclear weapon anywhere between 80 to 100 nuclear weapon, depending who you listen to. So how can he claim that he's going to have the whole area become nuclear free? And that is a problem for a lot of people to identify and understand what they're talking about. In addition to that, Iran has never really opened up and provided the necessary transparency for IAEA to be able to verify their claims. And they've done a number of programs, assessments and developments that they have done by hiding the information and later on being discovered, similarly in 2002, 2009, and recently in terms of the amount of, as I said, the amount of 235 enriched 20%. So there are a lot of things that causes that kind of suspicions in for other countries, and that's my view of it.
From the military perspective, Admiral Gallagher, why do we think that they're developing nuclear weapons as opposed to nuclear power?
Well, thanks, Jennifer, and thanks very much to the Hinckley Institute and to Kirk Jowers for this invitation. Just a point of order is I'm now retired U.S. Navy, so I'm speaking as a private citizen, but with some background in the area. Been operating in the Arabian Gulf for over 20 years, done extensive planning in that region, studying the region. I'm a carrier fighter pilot, commanded a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, so I am a nuclear power plant certified operator, although I do not have your background in radiological effects, but I have some familiarity with the discussion with the region. When you enrich uranium to produce nuclear power in a civilian plant, you enrich it to 3.5%. That's plus or minus. In fact, you can do it at even a lower level. As Dr. Samnani has pointed out, they've not only enriched to 3.5%, they've enriched a very large quantity to 20%. And the Iranian argument is that 20% is what's required for nuclear medicine-related research. And as he's also pointed out, that's, and I don't have a number that they should have to do nuclear medicine research, except that what they have is far in excess of what's required, far in excess. But 20% enrichment level is sort of a, it's a boundary, because when you go beyond that in enrichment, you now are heading towards, there's only one last place you go past 20%, and that's 90% or greater, and that's nuclear weapons grade material at that point. And the advantage for the Iranians of going above 3.5% to 20% is that it gets them that much closer to the ability to break out and dash, and those are two terms you'll hear in the media quite often, which basically is a fast run towards producing their first nuclear weapon. And the estimates, and they do vary a bit, but the estimates are that they have enough 20% to produce enough 90% to give them in excess of probably 4 nuclear weapons were they to do that today. So there's no reason to be doing what they are doing. There's no reason to bury the Fodor facility so far underground that it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to strike. So the arguments don't match the reality, and that's of course feeds the policy dilemma that we are in today, which is not only our government but numerous other governments have said Iran cannot have nuclear weapons. It's a hard line. The fact that they're proceeding that direction, and if allowed to continue to proceed, and if they don't stop themselves or someone else doesn't stop them, then they will achieve that. And that's the policy dilemma that we have today.
Senator Bennett?
Excuse me. I don't have the background to comment any further on the science that's involved here. But it is entirely possible for a nation to develop nuclear power facilities without doing anything that would take them across the line towards a nuclear weapon. And there are international groups available to assist countries who want to do that, who have been reaching out to the Iranians for a long period of time saying, if you want nuclear power, you can have nuclear power. That's been the United States position all along. If you want to have a nuclear power electric grid in Iran, you're a sovereign nation. You have every right to develop that and every economic incentive to do that. Nuclear power makes a lot of sense. Less now in the United States because of the price of natural gas, but we did it. Other countries, there's no reason why you should be denied the right to do it. Let us help you, and help you in a way that will make it clear you're not developing a nuclear weapon. And they have rebuffed every such overture from every other country in the world, and that's what makes us all so suspicious.
You mentioned the international community's response. Of course, the international community has imposed very harsh sanctions on Iran to persuade the country to back away from these nuclear ambitions. Are the sanctions working, Senator Bennett?
That is very hard to tell. It's, excuse me, I apologize to your radio audience for clearing my throat. But
we'll edit that right out.
I'm just at the tail end of a cold. The best intelligence we can get is that the regime in Iran is still not sure which way it wants to ultimately go. It's obvious they want the option of developing a weapon, and they have gone to the point where they are keeping that option very much open. But it's also apparent that wild as they may be by our view of political wisdom, they're still not quite sure they want to cross that line. And the sanctions have been a very strong pressure in saying to them, if you do cross that line, you become a pariah. You do cross that line, you have no friends. And increasingly, they have no friends now as other nations come in. to the American initiative to put sanctions on them. And there's no question it's hurting their economy. Understand this one fundamental truth, which most people do not. We talk about the Iranians as if this is a monolithic society. The Iranian people, by and large, are the most pro-American people in the world. The Iranian government is perhaps the most anti-American government in the world. And one of the reasons why the Iranian people are so strongly pro-American is they hate their government. And they want to be in a position of opposition to where their government is. But they have no control over their government. Elections in Iran are a complete farce. It's the religious group that determines who can run. So it isn't that a candidate loses, it's that somebody who might do something about this doesn't get his name on the ballot. And the Ayatollah determines who can be on the ballot, and if somebody suggests that upon winning the presidency he might reach out to the West, the Ayatollah makes sure he doesn't appear. So the elections are a complete farce. The Ayatollah and the imams are in complete control of the government itself. And the government responding to their agenda is violently anti-American. The Iranian people, hating their government, are strongly pro-American. One of the dilemmas that adds to our problem here is that if there were to be a military strike in Iran, it would have the psychological effect of causing the Iranian people to rally around their government, which is something we don't want to have happen. It is about as tortured a geopolitical dilemma as you can find anywhere in the world.
Khosrow Semnani, I mean, you have written extensively about the way forward needs to include democracy. Do we see on the horizon Arab Spring, Arab uprisings in Iran's future that would lead to a pathway to democracy?
I'm glad you asked that question. It's a good question because, you know, prior to Arab Spring, in 2009, if some of you might remember that, Iranian people, they were out in the street trying, they call it the Green Revolution, if you remember in CNN, there was quite a bit of talk about that. They were asking for democracy. They were trying to find the way that they have a more representative government. They have a government that not only is in peace with its own people, is in peace with the rest of the world. And that really was the genesis of, you know, the movement, that most recent genesis of the movement of Arab Spring even. So there is effort by Iranian people to get something like this going. The dilemma or the problem that exists today for Iranian people is how does the world really react to them? As the senator really pointed out, is, you know, the issue of the sanctions and the relationship of U.S. with American people has been an issue. And I think more proactive, more articulate, I would say, is America towards the Iranian people, it will help and assist and probably would bring better results sooner.
That's Khosrow Semnani, an industrialist who wrote the recent report, The Ayatollah's Nuclear Gamble. He was joined on a panel with former Senator Bob Bennett and Vice Admiral Richard Gallagher, who recently retired as military representative to NATO. They were answering the question, should the U.S. go to war with Iran? A panel discussion hosted by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah on Monday. We'll have more of the discussion after a short break. Stay with us. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're bringing you some excerpts from a discussion held Monday at the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. The discussion was titled provocatively, "Should the U.S. go to war with Iran?" Answering that question, former U.S. Senator Bob Bennett, Vice Admiral Richard Gallagher, who recently retired as a U.S. military representative to NATO, and Khosrow Semnani, an Iranian-American scientist scientist and philanthropist who recently published the policy report The Ayatollah's Nuclear Gamble, which explores the human costs of an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. I acted as the moderator.
So we have this very volatile situation going on in Iran. And then last week, Iranian warplanes shot at an American surveillance drone that was flying in international airspace, at least the Americans claim. I'm wondering, Admiral Gallagher, are the Iranians looking for a fight? I mean, do you see this as provocation?
That's a great question. And whenever we look at individual acts, it's always an important question of, well, was that driven by orders from on high in the central government, or was it the actions of a local commander? And what were they really trying to do? I can tell you that in my experience, both commanding an F-14 squadron operating in the Gulf during Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and then commanding an aircraft carrier later in the Gulf, the Iranian forces, generally speaking, are extremely professional. And if you communicate with them, as we do, so that we don't literally and figuratively bump into each other, the tendency is for each other to treat each other at least well enough to not cause problems. That doesn't mean that they don't occur. It means that generally speaking, the intent is not to inflame a situation. Because it is an article of fact and faith on both sides that were a greater conflict to be caused in the Arabian Gulf, for instance, the closing of the Straits of Hormuz, which would be an extreme example, but one of the potential outcomes of say a strike. The article of faith and fact is that the Straits would not remain closed very long, and the Iranian forces in the Gulf would not last very long. And this is very well understood, and it's very well understood by everyone involved. And so that's why normally, and in my experience, if an Iranian aircraft in his own airspace was approaching our airspace, because as you pointed out, the Predator, I think, was operating at 16 miles, 4 miles outside of Iranian territorial airspace, which is normal, as you described it, international airspace. That's exactly what that is. But as our forces approach each other, in my experience, we would communicate with each other and warn each other that you're getting close to my airspace. And in the past, I found those communications to be handled in a very professional way. So were they testing? Perhaps. Because probing, feinting, and testing is a time-honored military tradition to find out, well, what's the reaction going to be? Because if you were you to shoot down a drone, while it has certain effects that are, you know, undesired on both sides, it's probably not as, you know, as severe as other actions that could be taken.
So if they're looking, if they may be testing the waters a little bit, what message did they get from us? I mean, a lot of the debate had to be about the timing of when this information mm-hmm. was actually revealed in relationship to the election, rather than the action itself.
Well, I think the one of the messages is, and this is consistent with the way our military operates, and I'm having been associated with NATO, with the NATO forces, is that you try not to inflame a situation until you understand it. And until you get the larger picture of what's happening. So there isn't necessarily going to be an immediate retaliatory effect because they took a few shots at a Predator. You know, one of the answers is, so what? And because, again, you know, when we react in a very coordinated, well-thought way in my history of 36 years of active duty. And it may not be a reaction that day if there's going to be one. You know, it may take a day or two or three later. But so I'm not sure what the message was that they got other than, well, we weren't very happy about that. Please don't do it again. Hmm. And you know, we'll see what happens next.
Senator Bennett, last week Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he could unilaterally decide to attack Iran with or without the U.S. or other support. During the debates, Vice President Joe Biden called the concerns bluster. So what's your take? Is this bluster on Netanyahu's part?
I don't know Netanyahu very well. I've only met him once. So it would be presumptuous for me to do anything beyond speculation. I would point out to him, if we were to have a conversation, and the admiral can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the Israelis have the capability to do what they believe they did in Iraq, what was it, 20 years ago, something like that. Some of the things that have to be taken out are in hardened sites. And if you're going to do it, it's my impression you're going to have to do it with American cruise missiles. You can't do it with F-18s and a few bombs. And if he can't accomplish it, making the attempt and falling short would be the worst possible thing that would happen, because no one in the Middle East will believe that Israel acted unilaterally, even if they did. The assumption would be the Americans gave you a wink and a nod and told you to do it, and the Americans are responsible. And my position, I do not want to take the military option off the table. I think that's very bad diplomacy to start out negotiating with yourself. So you start out saying the military option is still on the table. But I think the Americans should have the ultimate control of who pulls the trigger, simply because they are going to be blamed no matter what happens. And if indeed it is the right thing to do, the Americans are going to have to be the ones to do it right.
That leads
now,
to
Admiral, you can correct me on that. That's my impression from the briefings I've had, which are now 2 years old. And if the situation is different than I've described, please set me straight.
Admiral?
Senator, I think everything you've said is entirely correct. The U.S. would certainly like to have a vote in anything that were to happen that wasn't going to be U.S.-led. One of the big questions is will we? And I can't answer that for you.
No, I can't either. My guess is that Netanyahu is not a stupid man and will not do stupid things.
And I think if you look at the Israeli leadership, what Netanyahu has said recently tracks with previous statements by himself, and what Barak has said recently and previously track with. So there are discussions and arguments even going on within the Israeli leadership. To one of your points, can the Israelis launch a strike? Yes, they can. They certainly can. One of the many questions is will we know about it? Don't know until it occurs. And what effect will it have, as you very correctly brought up? Well, that depends on the assets that you have available to you and what your target is. And the targeteering discussion is a very lengthy discussion, but it boils down to, do you have what it takes? I mentioned the four-door facility, which is built under a mountain, probably the most difficult single target in this particular discussion that we're having, where they have today just shy of about 3,000 centrifuges, where 600 just went in recently. Again, this gets back to the discussion about how much do you need. Well, they probably have a lot more than is required, and why do you bury it under a mountain? But this really creates a targeting problem. And Senator, you also correctly point out that, well, you know, do you really want to do this if you can't achieve your goals? And one of the most important aspects of military planning, when guys like me and the people I've worked for are sent off to plan events, strikes, the central question that has to be answered first is, what is the objective? What is the objective? And then how do you get there? What are your assumptions? What are the risks? And the assumptions all have to be correct, and they have to be answered, yes, you know, that's a true assumption. if any of your assumptions fall out, then the plan falls apart and has to be re-recorded. So
can the objective here be boiled down to something as simply, you know, we cannot allow Iran to have nuclear weapons, period?
Well, and that gets to the point I made earlier, which is the U.S. and the larger international community have said no, they cannot. But they're on a path that allows them to head that direction, and unstopped, one assumption is that they will achieve that capability. So you have a policy dilemma, you know. So what do you do about it? So now we, you know, one is sanctions. You asked about, are they working? As the senator said, that's a very tough question. Are they having effect? You can answer, yes, they are. Their fuel export, oil export, is down from 2.5 million barrels a day to about 1 million barrels a day now, because the EU signed on to this sanction restriction, as well as the United States and a number of other nations. The currency has been devalued 40% this year, just this year. So there are effects, but are they taking us in the direction we need to go before the Iranian leadership decides to then pursue and then quickly, you know, build a nuclear device? That's the big question right now, is, you know, what's going to come first?
Senator Bennett, maybe you could expand on this a little bit. You mentioned that military strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities would have echoes throughout the region. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? What kind of reaction do you think Middle Eastern communities would have to a U.S. strike on Iran, even very targeted strikes?
Yeah, it would depend on the provocation and the state of play at the time they were made. When we went into Iraq, just about every nation in the neighborhood, whatever they said publicly, privately cheered and said, anything we can do to get rid of Saddam Hussein in our neighborhood is a good thing to do. Now, maybe they didn't say that for domestic consumption, but that consensus was overwhelming in the international community of information that was available to the State Department and the Defense Department. Nobody was sad to see Saddam Hussein go. Now, I don't think anybody would be sad to see the Ayatollah go, but this is different. And the way it would be done and the provocation, the specific tripwire that would be crossed, all of that would have to be evaluated in terms of the kind of reaction that other nations would have. The expectation is that it would be very negatively viewed in every Muslim country, that it would be viewed as an inappropriate American intervention, however much they support the sanctions and however much they're with us on their fear of a nuclear weapon. On the other hand, if indeed the trigger was something that caused them to fear Iran, if there was fear of Iran in places other than Israel,
if they're the bully,
there was fear in the Middle East from places other than Israel with respect to Saddam Hussein. If there was fear in the region of Iran other than in Israel, then there might be some remonstrations in the press, but some quiet. Thank goodness the Americans came again. Bernard Lewis, who is an authority in the region, and he has his critics, but he told us, he said, the only thing you can believe out of the Middle East are the jokes. Those are the only thing that are not censored. And then he repeated two jokes. They're old now because they tied to the Iraq War, and that's now ancient history in the speed with which things change. But the first one was, on the streets of Iraq, streets of Iran, somebody said, the Americans are coming and they're going to attack Iraq. And they said, why don't they do it in alphabetical order? And the second one was, two Iranians are talking. We have terrible problems in this country. What are we going to do? We've got to do this. We've got to do that. Finally, one says, I know. We've got to get ourselves an Osama bin Laden. And he said, are you crazy? That would make things even worse. He said, no, if we had an Osama bin Laden, the Americans would come and save us. So you never, ever know. And that's why making a decision prematurely and an announcement prematurely that you are going to war or that you are not going to war is never a good idea. This is one circumstance where you want to keep all of your options open until the very last moment. So any projections I might make about this is how they would react and that is how they react, right now I think the reaction would be extremely negative and extremely harmful to the United States.
But that could change.
But that could change, which is why I said I would say we have to keep the military option on the table, because you never know what the circumstances might be.
Khosrow Semnani, during your presentation, you mentioned that the Iranian people are not aware of the threats that are being tossed around in the international conversations and conversations here in Utah. Why are they not aware of this posturing and the very real threat that faces them?
There are two issues, really. The study that we put together, really, it very, very intentionally pulls out the effect of the chemicals and radioactive material that exists in these facilities that eventually would be propagated into population centers. This whole idea was not really considered, at least not publicly considered, in the United States, not talked about in the United States. And just as importantly, not talked about in Iran. Talking about the nuclear program at any level, regarding any section of it, is illegal in Iran. They are not supposed to, any of the newspapers, radios, they are not supposed to discuss that. So the whole idea of environmental effect, as well as the human cost of an attack on military facilities in Iran, was never discussed. And Iranian people were not aware of it. So with this study, that's what we try really to do. It's really the whole idea of educating the people who are going to be exposed to this thing in advance rather than later. I mean, the whole idea is, I would equate it as it's smarter to build the fence at the top of the cliff rather than build a hospital at the bottom of it. You want to prevent the war to the extent you can in terms of the exposing and causing the casualty of the citizens. And then after it happened, and then eventually people, they have to be dealing with it. That's the concern that exists. And we believe through Voice of America and the number of other radio and television systems, we've already been able to communicate that with a lot of Iranian people. So I think I'm very, very satisfied with the kind of exposure we've had. And the whole discussion of including and introducing the human cost is important to this debate. And that is what I'm really trying to do, and I think we are doing that.
That's Khosrow Semnani in a segment from a Hinckley Institute of Politics discussion titled, Should the U.S. Go to War with Iran? We heard perspectives from former U.S. Senator Bob Bennett and Vice Admiral Richard Gallagher as well. Coming up next, Adventures in the Great Outdoors with the best-selling author Mark Omasek. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.